Welcome to the reading of the Thursday, March 21, Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger, and here's our first story in the Globe Gazette in 1 second. And the headline is Black Hawk Downtown, Iowa National Guard. It's a picture of the members of the crew members of the 11th 33rd Transportation Company. They're preparing a Black Hawk helicopter for a tour of Cedar Lake and Mason City on Tuesday afternoon. That's today. Helicopter flew low around the area to give civilian attendees of the National Guard employer outreach day a taste of the skills members develop through the service. Helicopters showcase for employer outreach day. It is titled. Robin McClelland wrote this. Clear Lake and Mason City residents may have seen Black Hawk helicopters flying low in the sky Tuesday afternoon. Flights were part of an Iowa National Guard employer support of the Guard and Reserve employer outreach day. As I said earlier, the event was held in part at the National Guard Armory and in part at Mason City Municipal Airport. Brigadier General William F. McClintock welcomed attendees with a brief description of the benefits of having U.S. military service members as employees. He emphasized that Iowans who serve in the National Guard make a commitment of 1 weekend per month and 2 weeks over the summer to be ready for any duty they may be called to perform. The Employer Outreach Day was an opportunity for soldiers to tell business leaders what they do and the skills they have developed in the Guard. Staff Sergeant Madison Dudka has spent 6 years with the 11th 33rd Transportation Company based out of Mason City. She joined just 17 years old, and along with developing sought-after skills, she has enjoyed the opportunity to connect with other soldiers. Being able to build those relationships is important, she said. On our Wisconsin mission, we had cookouts and would play the guitar and sing at night, and it was just a good time. Colin Hale, rather Hall, spent 9 years with the 11th 33rd and now works in the maintenance shop as a civilian. He volunteered to talk with participants about the 984A2 recovery vehicle he's been trained to operate. Every member of the 11th 33rd is trained to drive the 915A5 fire freightliner, but to operate the recovery vehicle requires advanced training. It took a 16-day course at Camp Dodge, said Hall. Recovery can be complicated with vehicles this size. Captain Nate Hoeger, H-O-E-G-E-R, commander of the 11th 33rd, sees the soldiers of this company as vital members of the community as well as his unit. He praised ESGR volunteers Becky Cody and Dan Fair, F-E-H-R, for the efforts they make to connect Guard members with jobs, opportunities, and services they need to be successful. Fair, in particular, has an excellent sense of what service members need. He's a former commander of the 11th 33rd himself. In addition to employers, Mason City Mayor Bill Schickel, Fire Chief Eric Bullinger, and Police Chief Jeff Brinkley were in attendance. The city is one of many employers that recruit current and former military members. Following the presentation, participants gathered at the Mason City Municipal Airport. There they were divided into three groups, and each group took a 20-minute helicopter tour of the area. Pilots flew out along Highway 122, and upon arriving at Clear Lake, traveled out over the water and along the shoreline to give passengers a bird's-eye view of the beautiful tourist town. Coming back along 19th Street Southwest, the flight crew came up from the south of downtown Mason City and made a loop around Central Park before returning to the airport. And story two on the front page. Headline is Second AEA Proposal Passes as School Leaders Voice Opposition. It's written by Aaron Murphy of the Globe Gazette. A dateline is Des Moines. State House Republicans have approved two different proposals to overhaul the operation and funding of Iowa's 9 area education agencies, which provide special education services and other supports to K-12 schools. Meantime, separate coalitions of K-12 superintendents reached out to state lawmakers to express their respective support for and opposition to the proposals. Senate Republicans passed their version of AEA changes Monday at the Capitol. This proposal is similar to one presented by Governor Kim Reynolds earlier this year, but significantly different from one House Republicans passed last month. Deeply concerned, on Sunday, a group of 32 K-12 Iowa superintendents made their feelings on both proposals clear when they emailed all state legislators to express their opposition to the plan. Among the signatories were Darwin Lehman of the Central Springs and Forest City School Districts and Barb Schwammann of Osage and Riceville School Districts. "Our message is clear. We are deeply concerned about the proposed changes to the AEAs, especially the shift towards a fee-for-service approach," states the emailed letter. And it went on to say, "The value of the AEA system as designed is that it's a cooperative that ensures that every school district, regardless of size or location, has access to the services it needs to serve students." The letter continues, and it says, "Rural school districts in particular rely heavily on AEAs for critical support, disrupting a model that has largely worked over the past 50 years will have grave consequences for the students we serve," it said. Another group of 18 superintendents, including Doug Gee in Clear Lake, signed a letter to legislators in which they expressed support for the legislative effort to change AEA operations and funding. Quote, "We advocate for AEA reform in this session," the letter says and continues, "We recognize the valuable role that AEAs play in supporting our schools and educators, also as advocates for the well-being of our students. We believe it is essential. For education systems to continually evaluate their effectiveness and identify areas for improvement. Currently, state federal funding is sent directly to the area education agencies, which provide services to school districts in their region. The AEAs are most prominently used in supporting special education students, those who have an individualized education plan, or IEP. AEAs also provide professional development for teachers, crisis response programs, and media services, among others. Under the Senate's bill, which is much closer aligned with Reynolds' proposal, AEA funding would be transitioned to a fee-for-service model through which AEAs would provide special education and other services only if requested by a school district. That annual uncertainty, critics of the proposal say, would jeopardize the entire AEA system. Both proposals create a new AEA oversight division in the Iowa Department of Education. The House version keeps the current funding structure largely in place. State funding for special education services would go to the school districts, and they would be required to use that funding with the AEAs. Senate Republicans approved their proposal, an amended version of Senate File 2386, on Monday. Only Republicans voted in favor of the bill, while six Senate Republicans joined all Democrats in voting against it. Senators Waylon Brown, Mike Klemisch, Mark Lofgren, Charlie McClintock, Sandy Salmon, and Jeff Taylor. During Senate debate, Senator Lynn Evans, Republican Aurelia, and former teacher, principal, and superintendent said the changes are needed because the U.S. Department of Education has since 2018 categorized Iowa as needs assistance under the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. He said, "This bill's about ensuring that our children with disabilities receive the best possible services and education. The goal is to get the best return on investment for the delivery of special education services to the kids who need them. This is the right direction to go. We need more local control on how these dollars are spent," he said. And Senate Democrats proposed pausing the AEA reforms and establishing a task force to spend a year studying the agencies and making recommendations to lawmakers before next year's legislative session. They criticized Republicans for not listening to the outpouring of educators and parents who have expressed opposition to the AEA proposals and the process by which the legislation has been proposed and passed. Democrats pointed to a recent Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll which showed 56% of Iowans have a favorable view of AEAs. State House Republicans have once again maybe listened, but they did not hear their constituents. Because if they heard their constituents in Iowa, they told them resoundingly to not do anything to this AEA system. Senator Molly Donahue, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, who has worked for 43 years as a special education teacher, said during the debate. Donahue said she had benefited from AEA services as a special education teacher and as a child when she spoke with a lisp. The fact is, I wouldn't be standing here talking to anybody at all had I not had those services, she said. Reynolds has said the AEA system needs updating and has claimed that Iowa's special education students are falling behind other students, other states. And although the test scores she has used as an example are also used by the federal government, the company that designs the test has said the scores should not be used to inform policy changes. Reynolds' administration hired a consultant to review the AEA system and recommended changes process, a process that Democrats roundly criticized as biased. I want to thank the Senate for their commitment to improving special education and acknowledging that the AE system needs reforms. Reynolds said in a statement, I now look forward to working with the House and Senate to reach a compromise that will bring transparency, accountability, and consistency to the AEA system, while most importantly, improving outcomes for students with disabilities. There is a proposal for teacher pay in this also, and then what's next for the bill? House Republicans passed their AEA bill, House File 2612 on February 29, with a 53-41 vote. Only Republicans supported the bill. 9 Republicans joined all Democrats in voting against it, with both Republican-led chambers having approved their respective AEA bills. Leaders from each chamber and Reynolds will need to reach an agreement on a proposal that can pass both chambers and be signed into law by Reynolds. Page 3 of the Gazette, story called Iowa Lawmakers Move to Ease Ethanol Transition for Gas Stations, written by Caleb McAuliffe. Dateline is Des Moines. Iowa gas stations would have more flexibility in updating their pumps to comply with renewable fuel rules under a bill Senate lawmakers advanced on Wednesday. The bill, Senate Study Bill 3187, builds on a 2022 law that requires most Iowa fuel retailers to offer E15 gasoline blended with 15% ethanol by 2026. The law also required new fuel infrastructure be compatible with the higher blended E85 fuel, which can be used by some flex fuel cars. Under the proposed bill, retailers that install new pumps and infrastructure would be able to transition to E85 compatible equipment more slowly. Until 2025, new pumps would only need to be compatible with E15 fuel. Starting July 1, 2025, new infrastructure would need to be compatible with E40 fuel, and infrastructure would need to be E85 compatible by 2030. Republican Senator Dan Zumba of Ryan said the bill would give retailers more time to update their equipment without incurring the large cost that comes with E85 infrastructure. The reason this bill came into play is to give some time to the manufacturers to get the equipment available for these retailers to put in place, he said. And until that time, it'll lower their cost to not have to have as expensive equipment until that time arrives. Zumbach and 2 other lawmakers voted to advance the bill out of a Senate subcommittee on Wednesday. It is now eligible for a hearing in the full Senate Appropriations Committee. Iowa officials have long sought to boost the production and sales of ethanol-blended fuels. Iowa is the largest national producer of both ethanol and the corn used to make it, and more than half of corn grown in Iowa is used in ethanol production. E15 gasoline is generally around 10 to 20 cents cheaper per gallon than standard E10 gasoline. The Iowa Renewable Fuels Association, which represents Iowa's ethanol manufacturers, has registered in support of the bill. Sarah Allen, a lobbyist for the association, said it would lead to more ethanol being sold in the state. A lobbyist for the Iowa Corn Growers Association said they would prefer if the legislature increased the grants offered to retailers to update their infrastructure rather than changing the requirements. We think you passed an amazing bill in the legislature in 2022, and we think that that is actually still the best course, said the association's lobbyist, Mindy Moberg. Our first preference would be if, instead of the delay, we would implement the current bill but raise the cap from the $50,000 amount, she said. The Iowa Renewable Fuel Infrastructure Program provides grants to fuel retailers to pay for equipment upgrades, doling out grants up to $50,000 for those projects for large retailers. Lawmakers increased the grant amount and cost share for small retailers in the 2022 law. Representatives for Iowa's gas stations had mixed thoughts on the bill. Quick Trip has registered in support, and their lobbyist Larry Blixt said E15 is the company's most popular product. Allowing retailers to more easily transition to E15 infrastructure would increase those sales, he said. A representative for Casey's General Store said he was concerned that some required equipment compatible with E40 gasoline would not be widely available by the July 2025 deadline. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency recently approved a request from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and other Midwestern governors to permanently waive a summer restriction on E15 and sell it year-round. E15 sales are generally restricted in the summer months because of environmental concerns. An Iowa hospital nurse charged with overdosing patients is the headline of this story written by Clark Kaufman, Iowa Capital Dispatch. An Iowa hospital nurse has pleaded not guilty to criminal charges that she deliberately overdosed patients with medications. Rachel Faith Martinez, 36, of Peterson, is charged with six criminal violations related to her work at Clay County Spencer Hospital in late 2022. Charges include two felony counts of obtaining a prescription drug by deceit and four counts of wanton neglect of a dependent adult by a caretaker, a serious misdemeanor. Martinez has pleaded not guilty to each of the charges. According to prosecutors, Martinez was working as a nurse at Spencer Hospital November 9, 2022, was caring for a patient who was to receive hydrocodone once every 4 hours. Martinez allegedly provided the drug at 11:04 a.m., 12:39 p.m., and 3:47 p.m. Same patient was to be given Tramadol once every 6 hours, although Martinez allegedly administered the drug at 7:12 a.m., 9:04 a.m., 12:33 p.m., and 1:39 p.m. In December of 2022, Martinez was assigned to care for a patient being treated for an allergic reaction related to cancer treatment. Prosecutors allege that Martinez told a fellow nurse the patient was being annoying and was using their call light to summon assistance, and so she administered the patient an unprescribed dose of Benadryl, put them to sleep. A few weeks earlier, Martinez had been assigned a different patient who was to receive one dose of hydrocodone every 4 hours. According to prosecutors, she instead administered two doses within the four-hour time frame and then administered Zofran, morphine, and Tramadol. All of these extra narcotics with the hydrocodone would have further overdosed the patient, prosecutors allege. A few days before that incident, Martinez was assigned to care for a patient who was prescribed 3 milligrams of melatonin at bedtime. Martinez is accused of providing 6 milligrams. Prosecutors allege that on two other occasions, Martinez took, for her own use, Tramadol and hydrocodone prescribed for patients of the hospital. A pretrial conference in the case is scheduled for April 16. Turning to the opinion section in the Globe Gazette today, this is another view from the Washington Post. It's entitled, A Step Toward Lower Costs for Medicare. Site-neutral payments for chemotherapy could save billions under the House bill. And it reads, as if to prove that every rule has an exception, the usually dysfunctional Republican majority House of Representatives has at least one sensible piece of bipartisan legislation on its record. In December, it passed a health care measure called the Lower Cost, More Transparency Act on a 320-71 vote. Also contrary to Congress's occasional practice, the bill's name is not hype. It actually would end a long-standing but irrational disparity in Medicare reimbursements for certain treatments, depending on whether they are administered in doctors' offices or hospitals. The savings would be more than $3.7 billion over the next decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office, and beneficiaries' co-payments would go down to and by $40 a visit. The next thing that needs to happen is for the Senate to follow suit. At issue is how Medicare pays for drugs delivered by medical providers, such as chemotherapy for cancer or infusions used to treat autoimmune diseases. Under current law, Medicare pays 2 to 3 times as much for these treatments if they are given in a hospital rather than a doctor's office. The medicines and the means of administering them are the same, only the price is different. In theory, the difference reflects the higher cost involved in running a full-service 24/7 hospital as opposed to a physician's office that keeps weekday hours. In practice, though, Medicare's rules have created an incentive for hospitals to buy up physicians' practices, at which the hospitals can then charge the higher rate and pocket the profits. In 2021, Medicare paid hospital rates for more than half of the chemotherapy services it funded, up from a little more than a third in 2012. Indeed, research has found that consolidation among providers brings higher prices for everyone, including private medical insurers, often large corporate employers, and their beneficiaries. Larger medical systems have greater bargaining power in the healthcare marketplace. This legislation would also save money for private insurers, which pay hospitals almost double the Medicare rate. The Lower Cost, More Transparency Act would basically end these discrepancies for all drugs that must be administered by a healthcare provider as opposed to, say, taken orally at home. Instead, it aims to create site-neutral payments. Site-neutral payment policy for Medicare would not be a cut to hospital funding, as the American Hospital Association and other defenders of the status quo claim. It would only do away with a payment disparity that has unintentionally caused higher costs. The House bill would be a small but significant step toward lower, more transparent Medicare payments. Just as the bill's title says, before this Congress ends, the Senate should send it to President Joe Biden for his signature. In the obituary section today, we have a couple. I'm going to read most of this one. This is Dolores Marie Marzen, M-A-R-Z-E-N, and Marie in quotes is M-A-U-R-E-E. And Dolores Maureen, 89, was called home to heaven on Tuesday, the 19th of March. Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center, her children, her 6 children and husband of 70 years were there to comfort her. She was a resident of Kentucky Ridge in Mason City, but lived the majority of her life on a farm near Doherty, Iowa. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 25, at Holy Name Catholic Church, Rockford, Iowa, with celebrant Reverend Franz Augustin. Visitation will be prior to the service from 9 to 10 a.m. at the church. Rosary service will begin at 10 a.m. Burial will be held in St. Patrick's Cemetery, Doherty, Iowa, and a lunch will follow at St. Patrick's in Doherty. Dolores was born August 15, 1934, in Longmont, Colorado, the only child of Dorothy and Clifford Bud Spiller. As a teenager, following her father's death, started her faithful journey of having a strong Catholic faith. She has been known to secretly tell her granddaughters a dream when she was younger to live in New York City, become an actress, and own 100 pairs of shoes. This plan changed when she met a handsome farmer, Gerald Marzen, on a trip to Iowa visiting family in 1950. They were married March 22, 1954, in Yuma, Arizona. Not easy for Dolores adjusting from a city girl to wife, but she adjusted well by learning to drive the tractor, learning to help with harvest, learning about cows and pigs, and mowing the lawn. She also never missed cooking a meal for her husband while taking care of 6 children. Also helping with adjusting to a small town, she was involved in many community and Catholic church activities, including president of American Legion Auxiliary for years, Catholic DRE, teaching CCD, lay ministry, and was ordained a Franciscan sister in November of 2018. Dolores also liked helping the ladies putting on the annual turkey dinner and won awards selling the most poppies with her church friends. And any memorial sent will be donated to the Franciscan order at a later date. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel on 3rd Street in Northeast Mason City, handling the arrangements. Here's a brief one for Janet Bonzer, B Bonzer, AD of Charles City, died Monday, March 18. Funeral is 10:30 a.m. Saturday, the 23rd of March, at Hauser Weiser Funeral Home in Charles. Burial at Riverside Cemetery, Charles City. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, the 22nd, that is tomorrow, at Hauser Weiser Funeral Home, and 1 hour prior to service. Going to move over to sports now and kind of give you a rundown of what's on the television. So listen to some games, and we know what's going on. It's that time of the year. College basketball men's CBS NCAA tournament, Michigan State versus Mississippi State. First round, Charlotte, North Carolina. It's 11:15. It's probably going on now. 11:40, it's True TV NCAA tournament, Duquesne versus BYU. First round, that's in Omaha. 12:30 p.m., TNT NCAA tournament, Akron versus Creighton. First round, it's in Pittsburgh. 1 p.m., you'll find on TBS, NCAA tournament, Long Beach State versus Arizona, first round of Salt Lake City. 1:45 p.m., CBS, you'll find NCAA tournament, to be determined, versus North Carolina, first round, it'd be Charlotte, North Carolina. 2:10 p.m., on True TV, NCAA tournament, Morehead State versus Illinois, first round, that's in Omaha. And 3 p.m., TNT, NCAA tournament, Oregon versus South Carolina, first round, that's in Pittsburgh. 3:30 p.m., TBS, NCAA tournament, Nevada versus Dayton, first round in Salt Lake City. 5:50 p.m., TNT, NCAA tournament, to be determined, versus Texas, first round, Charlotte, North Carolina. 6:10 p.m., CBS, NCAA tournament, Oakland versus Kentucky. It's a first round, it's in Pittsburgh. Then we're down to 6:25 p.m., TBS, NCAA tournament, McNeese State versus Gonzaga. First round, Salt Lake City. 6:35, True TV. Here we go, tournament, South Dakota State versus Iowa State. First round, they're in Omaha. That's 6:35 p.m. today. 8:20 today, TNT. NCAA tournament, St. Peter's versus Tennessee, first round, that's in Charlotte, North Carolina. And 8:40 is CBS at North Carolina State versus Texas Tech, first round, Pittsburgh. 8:55, TBS, NCAA, Samford versus Kansas, first round. And 9:05 p.m., True TV, NCAA tournament, Drake versus Washington State, first round. Those are the ones for today. Folks, you are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette, and we're soon going to go to the Fort Dodge Messenger. This is Thursday, March 21. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS programs, please give us a call, 515-243-6833. And now we're going to turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger and begin with the front page, which the story headline is Dayton Expo set for Saturday. Event showcases local businesses and groups. Fairly short story by Brandon Bruschke. And it says the 29th annual Dayton Expo will be held at the Dayton Community Center Saturday. The event will run from 9 a.m. until 1 p.m., during which all manner of local businesses will be showcased. The expo highlights local and area businesses, services, and goods. This event is sponsored by the Dayton Community Club, said Kevin Deal, an organizer of the event. He went on to say, we're inviting vendors to showcase their goods, and we have the pork producers coming to cook up some meat for a free will donation lunch. We are still open for more vendors, he said. When speaking a little about what it looks like on his end to run an event like this, Deal said, we have a small committee that sets things up in the background. As far as sending out the mailing list of past and possible new vendors and working with the pork producers, we've been doing this for the past 20-some odd years. Back before it was the Dayton Vendor Expo and it was the Dayton Ag Expo. It is free admission with a free will donation lunch provided by the Pork Producers and POET, Poet, at noon. There will also be free popcorn. All proceeds from the expo are to support the Dayton Community Center. The expo will be held at the Dayton Community Center, 104 First Street, Northwest in Dayton. Below that is this article written by Bill Shea, and it's entitled Meyer's Distracted Driving Bill Gets Pulled Over. Lawmaker vows to keep trying despite setback. A local lawmaker's proposal to ban the use of electronic devices while driving unless they are in a hands-free mode has again been stymied. State Representative Ann Meyer, Republican Fort Dodge, has unsuccessfully introduced that bill in the last three legislative sessions. On Wednesday, she said the bill is done for this year's session. Our leadership did not want the complete hands-free bill because they were concerned that older people, and younger people too, couldn't talk on the phone if they were having an emergency, she said. State Senate bill paired the hands-free requirement with a ban on traffic cameras used for speed enforcement, and that bill is also dead for this year, according to Meyer. She said pairing the hands-free provision with the traffic camera ban apparently ended it because, in quotes, everyone isn't willing to do a full ban, end quote. Well, Meyer has consistently described her proposal as a common-sense measure that will save lives. She said there have been two court cases stemming from crashes caused by drivers distracted by their electronic devices, and in each case, a judge ruled using the devices wasn't illegal. Meyer said Wednesday that she is not the only lawmaker getting emails and phone calls from people in favor of her proposal. The state already has a ban on texting while driving. The law states, quote, a person shall not use a handheld electronic communications device to write, send, or view an electronic message while driving a motor vehicle unless the motor vehicle is at a complete stop off the traveled portion of the roadway, end quote. Tweaking that law may be the way to achieve her goal, Meyer said. She said she will be working to address the distracted driving issue next year, and with no primary or general election opposition, Meyer seems assured of returning to the House of Representatives in 2025. Another story on the front page, reappraisal inspections to begin in rural Webster County. Assessor Angie Vinson announced that the door-to-door inspections of all agricultural and rural residential dwellings in Webster County will begin approximately April 1. A reappraisal project was approved by the Conference Board in February of 2021. The purpose of the reappraisal project is to equalize property assessments so that each taxpayer is responsible for paying only his or her fair share of the property tax burden. Periodic inspections and reappraisals of properties is necessary as all types of properties do not increase or decrease in value at the same rate. Some properties physically deteriorate faster than others, and in many instances, similar homes located in different areas of the country, rather county, will differ greatly in value due to economic factors. Data collectors will photo ID signed by the assessor, will make interior and exterior inspections of all rural residential properties. They will be compiling information to be used to estimate the fair market value of each property. Information to be collected includes type of construction, type of interior finish, physical condition of the property, age of structures and exterior measurements. A complete sales analysis, local construction cost, and economic conditions are also considered. No estimate of value will be given at the time of inspection. Property owners are asked to cooperate by allowing a complete inspection of their property and providing accurate information so that a fair and equitable assessment may be determined for each property. The project is scheduled for completion on December 31, 2025. Notice of final value estimates will be mailed to each property owner after January 1, 2026. Property owners will have an opportunity to meet informally to discuss their revaluation in the spring of 2026. The new assessed values will be effective for January 1 of 2026. for taxes payable in fiscal 2027-28. Representatives of Vanguard Appraisals Incorporated, in conjunction with the Webster County Assessor's Office, will be conducting this project. All law enforcement agencies, as well as Webster County Assessor's Office, will be appraised of the areas where data collectors are working. They will also have a listing of all the names and license plate numbers of anyone involved in the project. If any property owner has questions regarding the appraisal project, they are urged to contact the Webster County Assessor's Office, 515-576-4721, or email assessor@webstercountyia.gov. Here's an article from Page 3. It said French Bulldogs remain the most popular U.S. breed in new rankings, and many fans aren't happy. I'm going to read part of this. It says French Bulldogs, U.S. dog owners, c'est l'amour. Frenchies remain the United States' most commonly registered purebred dogs last year, according to American Kennel Club rankings released Wednesday. The club calls the Frenchie the most popular breed, though other canine consistencies may beg to differ. Is it a coup to be celebrated? Au contraire, say the longtime fans who rue what popularity is doing to the breed. Nevertheless, after lapping Labrador Retrievers to take the top spot in 2022, the bat-eared, scaled-down Bulldogs held on the new standings, which reflect puppies and other dogs that were added last year to United States' oldest dog registry. Meanwhile, dachshunds are at a nearly two-decade peak. The Cane Corso is making moves, and there's a new breed in the mix. Of course, purebreeds are only part of the canine population in the U.S., where animal shelters faced an influx of all sorts of dogs last year. And here's a snapshot. The top 10. After Frenchies, the most common breeds registered were Labs, Golden Retrievers, German Shepherds, and Poodles. Then came Dachshunds, Bulldogs, Beagles, Rottweilers, and German Short-Haired Pointers. Turning to the obituary section of today's paper, there are quite a few. I'm going to begin with Susan Rickey, R-I-C-K-E, 79, of Fort Dodge. She died Tuesday, March 19, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Service honoring Susan's life will be 10 a.m. Saturday, March 23, at Gunderson Funeral Chapel. Interment will follow at North Lawn Cemetery. The visitation is from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at Gunderson Funeral Home and cremation services. Memorials may be directed to the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Susan survived by her husband Jim, her daughter Anna Rusty McNeil, her grandchildren Jackson and Anthony, her sister-in-law Terry Weimer, and her brother James Case. She was preceded in death by her mother and father. She was born February 10, 1945 in Winfield, Kansas, graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High, and attended the University of Iowa. On March 19, 1976, she was united in marriage to Jim Rickey in Fort Dodge. Susan was employed with Iowa Medical Supply and with Frontier Telephone, from where she retired in 2010. Years ago, Susan helped with the ticker, which supplied information to broadcasters covering University of Northern Iowa Panther football games. And Vanita McKernan is the next one. Ocala, Florida. Vanita M. Brain Albrecht McKernan, 77, formerly of Gowrie and Farnhamville, passed away Monday, March 12, at Advent Health in Tampa, Florida. Funeral services will be held 11 a.m. Tuesday, the 26th of March, at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church, Farnhamville, with Pastor Aaron Zimmerman officiating. Graveside services will be held at 1:30 p.m. Tuesday, March 26, at Jefferson Municipal Cemetery with Military Rights by American Legion Post Number 510, Farnhamville. Friends may call after 10 a.m. Tuesday, March 26, at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church, Farnhamville. Palmer Funeral Home, Gowrie, is serving the family. Judy Andrews, 74, Fort Dodge, passed away Tuesday, March 19, at her home. There are no services planned at this time. Lofferschweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. Martha Viskoski, Eagle Grove Celebration of Life will be Saturday the 23rd, 12 to 3 p.m. at Rails Depot in Eagle Grove. FOUSTFH.com for more information. Edward Ed Champagne, 78 of Fort Dodge, passed away Saturday, March 16, 2024, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Friday in the chapel of Washeswater Funeral Home. Burial service with military rites will be 1:30 p.m. Thursday, March 28, at Fort Snelling National Veterans Cemetery in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The burial service will be live streamed via the Washeswater Funeral Home Facebook page. Ed is survived by his children, Aaron, Amy Champagne of Fort Dodge, Nicole Champagne, Eric Josephson of Fort Dodge, and Ryan, spouse Tara Champagne of Eagle Grove. Grandchildren, and he was preceded in death by his parents and by wife Barbara Champagne. He was born December 21, 1945 in Minneapolis. He attended area schools and graduated from Minneapolis Vocational High School and Technical Institute in 1964. On October 25 of 65, he was called to serve in the United States Army, served in Vietnam, was honorably discharged on June 28, 1967. He was united in marriage to Barbara Pemberton on July 6, 1968, and she passed away March 16 of 73. He remarried to Cindy Kenny on October 27, 1973. Couple later divorced. Ed was employed with Honeywell in Minneapolis before moving to Fort Dodge and starting work at KWMT. He worked at Land O'Lakes, Hormel, Earl May, and Fort Dodge Laboratories, enjoyed tennis, boxing, fishing, doing yard work, playing video games. Also enjoyed woodworking and finishing refurniture. And Sandy Newman, 74 years old, Manson, Iowa, died Monday, March 18, the Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames. Private family services will be held at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the family. Arrangements are with Historic Bruce Funeral Home of Fort Dodge to view the complete obituaries and leave online condolences for the family. You can visit brucesfuneral-home.com. Beverly Demery, D-E-M-E-R-Y, Fort Dodge, 86, peacefully departed from this world March 18 at Grandview Healthcare in Dayton. A graveside service will be held on Thursday, the 21st, 11 a.m. in the Washington Township Cemetery in Duncombe, Iowa. Frederick Gill Funeral and Cremation Care has been entrusted with the care of Bev at her home and her family. Kenneth Tuel, T-U-E-L, 79, Fort Dodge, passed away peacefully March 19, surrounded by family at the VA Community Living Center in Des Moines, Iowa. Celebration of life for Ken will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, March 22, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, 400 South 13th Street, Fort Dodge, with Reverend Jerry Rather and Reverend Kendall Meyer officiating. Visitation will begin at 9:30 a.m. until the time of the service. Interment will take place at North Lawn Cemetery with military honors conducted by the VFW Post 1856 and the U.S. Army Honor Guard. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Arrangements are with Historic Bruce Funeral Home of Fort Dodge to view the complete obituary and leave online condolences for the family. You may visit brucesfuneralhome.com. Laverne Dass, D-A-S-S, 89, of Fort Dodge, passed away Wednesday, the 20th of March, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Services are pending. Loftuswater Funeral Home is serving the family. Turning to sports here, Crooks is ISU's first freshman All-American. Is the story. It's for the first time in program history an Iowa State women's basketball freshman has entered All-American status. Audie Crooks was announced as an honorable mention AP All-American on Wednesday. Former Bishop Garrigan superstar and Iowa Miss Basketball is the 11th Cyclone to earn AP All-American honorable mention. Iowa State has now had one AP All-American for seven consecutive seasons. The Algona native led Iowa State with 18.9 points per game while collecting 7.7 rebounds per game. Crooks was a unanimous selection to the All-Big 12 first team and a Big 12 All-Team All-Tournament team member. The center has made over 58% of her shots from the floor, the best mark by a freshman in NCAA Division I this season. She has tallied 16 games of 20 points or more and has posted double-figure scoring in each of the last 29 games for the Cyclones. Crooks holds Iowa State freshman records for single-season points, 585, and field goals, 237, and is one from owning the made free throw record with 106 makes from the line. With her field goal total, she is also third all-time for Iowa State makes. She is also third all-time for Iowa State makes in a single season, regardless of class. Crooks is 17 makes from matching the all-time best for the Cyclones, set by Bridget Carleton, 254, in 2018 and 19. Her season total for points ranks 10th regardless of class for Iowa State. Iowa State returns to action Friday evening for the first round of the NCAA tournament when the 7th-seeded Cyclones take on number 10-seed Maryland. Tip is set for 6:30 p.m. in Stanford, California. Still in sports, going to go to a little wrestling story here. Four-time Dodger champ making fourth NCAA appearance, Kansas City, Missouri is the dateline, written by Chris Johnson. Brody Teske's mindset is simple this week. Take care of what's directly in front of him. The Iowa senior's path hasn't been a typical one, but it will end where he dreamed of being all along, the NCAA National Wrestling Tournament as a senior. I'm living the dream that I had as a kid, said the 2018 FDSH graduate. I wanted to wear the black and gold and enjoy my time as a collegiate competitor. I can't take anything for granted now, and I won't. I don't want to leave any stones unturned, he said. In his final season on the mat, Teske will wrestle in his fourth straight NCAA tournament, Teske 13-5. A four-time Fort Dodge state champion earned the 15th seed at 133 pounds and will face number 18 Derek Cardinal, 22-10, of South Dakota State on Thursday. I'm excited for the opportunity to compete as always, Teske said. I'm feeling good and I'm good to go. I'm enjoying this opportunity. I can only control what I control and that's how I move forward, he said. Teske was the 14th seed at the Big Ten tournament and pulled off three upsets, including a rally to defeat the number 3 seed in the opening round. It was just another tournament. At Big Tens. I wrestled whoever I had to, Teske said. Nothing is given. There are no guarantees. I can't worry about anything else out of my control. I have to be best prepared for what I can be and wrestle that way, he said. Teske knocked off several 7th-seeded Braxton Brown of Maryland, 4-1, to finish 5th at 133. The goal is to do the best I can at Nationals, Teske said. He continued, I have Drake Ayala on the same team, which is obviously great, and I've gained a special bond with my teammates. Teske's career began at Penn State, where he wrestled unattached and posted a 6-2 record. In his redshirt freshman year, he was 5-2 for the Nittany Lions before transferring to Northern Iowa at the semester. I appreciate everyone's support from the 515, Teske said. They've been with me since day one. It's been a longer journey than most, but I've been enjoying it and appreciating everyone and everything along the way. In 2021, Teske was a Big 12 champion and went undefeated in Big 12 duels for the Panthers. He qualified and competed in the NCAA championships as a number 5 seed at 125 pounds, where he went 2-2. Teske was then second at the Big 12 tournament in 2022. He entered the NCAA tournament as a 15th seed and finished with a 2-2 record. In his first season at Iowa last year, Teske made his third straight-up trip to the NCAA tournament at 133. He qualified for the field with a 7th-place finish at Big Ten Championships, was ranked as high as the 12th during the regular season. Still Fort Dodge all-time leader with a career mark of 177-1. And here's a story on Alea, the number 3 seed in wide open National Field at 125. Kansas City, Missouri, the Dateline. There's a lot of talk about a wide open race for the NCAA 125-pound wrestling championship this week. Drake Alea isn't listening to any of the outside noise. The Iowa sophomore and 3-time Fort Dodge state champion is doing what he has to do. It's kind of like in one ear and out the other, he said. I'm focusing on what I can do, not what it is about of my control, to be able to separate myself, he said. He was ranked as high as number 1 at 125 earlier this season. He enters this week's national field at the 3rd seed. I'm ready and excited. It's going to be a fun week, the 2021 FDSH graduate said. I've just got to be myself. When I'm Drake Ayaya, that's when the best product is on the mat and I'm wrestling my best. Making his second NCAA tournament appearance, he enters with a 23-4 record. His 4 losses are to 21st seed Brenton Kaler of Oregon State, Purdue's 4-seeded Matt Ramos, and twice to Michigan's 18th-seeded Michael DiGostino. He finished 3rd in the Big Ten tournament, returning the favor and knocking off Ramos in the bronze medal match. I don't think it's anything in particular. Changes needed, he said. I just need to make little adjustments here and there, and that will help make me make that jump, he said. He owns a 4-2 win over top-seeded Braden Davis, who is 20-2 of Penn State. He has not faced number 2 seed Luke Stanich, 19-3 of Lehigh. He will meet Elijah Griffin, 19-11 of California Baptist in the opening round, and he beat Griffin 18-8 in his first match of the season. Among the top 10 seeds, he is 7-1 with wins over number 1, 4, 5, 6, and 9, and 10 this season. And the NCAA tournament begins Thursday at noon. That's now. Friday's quarterfinals start at noon with the semifinals and blood round at 8 p.m. The medal round is at 11 a.m. on Saturday, and championship finals start at 7 p.m. on Saturday. Matches will be televised on ESPNU and ESPN+. So I think I'll turn now to the sports on TV for you can listen to, so you'll know when they are. This is the men's NCAA tournament for basketball. Michigan State versus Mississippi State, 11:15, CBS. Let's see, Creighton versus Akron, 12:30 p.m., TNT. Arizona versus Long Beach State, 1 p.m. on TBS. North Carolina versus Wagner, 1:45 p.m. on CBS. Illinois versus Morehead State, 2:10 p.m. on True, TRU. Oregon versus South Carolina, 3 p.m. on TNT. And Nevada versus Dayton, 3:30 p.m. on TBS. Texas versus Colorado, 5:50 p.m. on TNT. Kentucky versus Oakland, 6:10 p.m. CBS. Georgia, McKinsey State, 6:25 p.m. TBS. Iowa State versus South Dakota State, 6:35 on TRU. And then Drake versus Washington State, 9:05 on TRU. Go back to back up to 8:55. You got Kansas at Samford on TBS, and back up to Texas Tech versus North Carolina, 8:40 on CBS. And I think I mentioned this, the NCAA Wrestling Championships, 11 a.m. ESPNU and 6 p.m. ESPN. Well, folks, that about wraps it up for the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. This is Thursday, March 21. I've been your reader, Doug Kretzinger. I want to thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Center for the Blind. And I wish you all a very good day. Thank you. Thank you.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.